Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
In today's episode of Complicated Conversations, we welcome Hazel Hayes. Hazel is an Irish-born, London-based writer and director who for many years wrote primarily for the screen. After graduating from Dublin City University with a degree in journalism, she went on to study creative writing at the Irish Writers' Center before honing her craft as a screenwriter through numerous short films and sketches. Her 8-part horror, Prank Me, won Series of the Year at Social in the City, as well as the Award for Excellence in Storytelling at Buffer Festival in Toronto. Out of Love was her first novel, and her new novel, Better by Far, is out now. Welcome to Pop Fiction Women, Hazel.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, we are so excited to chat, but what we'd like to start with is just maybe you give our listeners the elevator pitch for Better by Far.
The elevator pitch.
I know. Okay. It's the worst.
it's so awful because it's like, but it's 100,000 words and it's that for a reason because I couldn't make it. If I could make it one sentence, yes. I wouldn't have written a book.
Right. It would be a short or a short story or something else.
It would have been a much simpler process, honestly.
Yeah,
the elevator pitch is on the surface, it is about a couple who break up. But they decide to keep sharing their home for another 3 months until the lease is up. A situation I think a lot of people have found themselves in. So they decide to alternate week on week, coming and going each week to the house. That grief, that sort of feeling of living with a ghost, of coming back to a home where someone has been the whole week, like a sort of poltergeist or a presence, starts to dredge up the grief of the narrator's, her name is Kate, of her mother's death. So she then has to try and juggle processing the grief of this romantic relationship ending.
Yeah. So if it's okay, I'd like to read a little from the opening paragraph, which I think encapsulates exactly what you're talking about so beautifully. I'm supposed to be writing a book, but instead I find myself writing to you. I prepare the blank page, ready to pour myself onto it, but all that comes out is your absence, which feels so much more like a presence. How odd that the language of grief is one of loss. People describe feeling empty, hollow, carved out. When for me, grief is heavy. There's a weight to it, a density. Oh, that was just, I mean, hooks you right in. And as you've said, Kate's dealing with grief on a number of levels. The surface level of this relationship, and then more deeply about her mother. So tell us about Kate, what inspired her, how you really got into her, or what challenges you faced when you were writing her.
Kate, she really became her own person. And I'm still figuring this out. This is only my second novel. And I think every time it begins with a seed of me. So every time it's almost like I'm loaning a little bit of DNA and then they're getting grown in a lab into this separate thing with their own memories and experiences. But there's this little seed of my genetics in her. Obviously her Irish roots and heritage, the way she sort of copes with grief. And then throughout the book, without spoilers, you'll kind of come to understand the way she's being affected on a very emotional and mental and cerebral level by grief and how her subconscious is sort of bleeding into the real world. Like that's all quite real for me. So fortunately, I did not lose my mother at a young age. She's alive and well. But I've known grief, and I think it comes in many different forms, but ultimately the crux of it and the core of it are very, very similar. And so, yeah, I sort of went on this journey with her, beginning in a space that I had been in before, where I had gone through a breakup and then was forced to share this space with somebody who I was no longer with, and you're in that weird liminal space. We're over, so we're not what we were, but I'm also not the person I'm going to be, and we're not the people we're going to be, and one day we're probably going to be strangers, but right now I don't even know what we would call each other, because we've gone from being the most intimate thing in each other's lives to nothing. But you're not dead and you're not gone, you're right there in a physical form, but I can't have you. It's just the strangest feeling. And so she's going through that, which is something I went through. But similarly, I was sort of dealing with an old grief at the time as well, But in her case, it's the loss of her mother, which is very different because when someone's dead, they're gone. They're completely gone. There's no choice to go back. You can't choose to pick up the phone and have them there. So she's sort of navigating this new grief. And going through it with her was harrowing. Yes. It was tough. Yeah, there were days like, I mean, I cried with her. I grieved with her. I stayed up nights with her. I spent so much time with her. And like to the point that there were days, there was one day towards the end of writing, I remember that like she was just in such a bad headspace. And I just felt for her and was in there with her. So I wrote this little piece about just a nice day for her that never really make it into the book. But I just needed to spend a day with her. Shrouded by grief.
Yes.
So I sort of took her off to the beach and we had like a night, which probably sounds mad to like non-writers, but I really got to know her and I really cared about her. And like when she was going through it, I would call my friends being like, hey, it's really sad.
Oh my God. I love that.
Let me just say, I just spent a weekend with readers and that would not sound weird to them because they feel that way too about characters that they hold on to, and they would take them to the beach and they want to hold their hand and give them a hug too. Yeah. So I think it makes complete sense as wild as it is.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's certainly not strange to us. So I want to stick with what you're talking about with the grief that comes from being stuck in this liminal space between loving someone and letting go, because personally, I just find that excruciating. Maybe it's my fixed nature. We're going to talk about astrology later, but I have such, Corinne knows this. I just have such resistance, more so, I think, than many people to letting go generally. And then when there's love there, I just forget it. I will white knuckle that. And yet you write beautifully something. You say that life takes place in the in-between when you've let go of the last rung and before you've got hold of the next. Life happens in the reach, the release, the free fall. And I'm like, oh, that's probably true, but I don't want to let go of the rung. So I would love to just hear more about why you wanted to explore that dynamic. It sounds like, you know, this was obviously something that was sort of personally something you were going through. And then maybe what you learned by the end, because it certainly seems like you went through the ringer with Kate on this too.
Yeah. Thank you, by the way. It's so strange and lovely to hear my words come out of someone else's mouth. Because it's still, I've been alone with this work for years. So these are kind of the first interviews I'm doing. So thank you. It's really lovely. Yeah, I think it was one of those cases where I had discovered a word for an experience, you know, those moments, and it's usually German or Japanese or Swedish. They have the best words. but the word liminality had kind of found its way into my lexicon, and I didn't know it before then. And I didn't know this idea. I knew the idea, but not the word for that space in between, that threshold. And liminal spaces can be physical. It could be literally a waiting room in a doctor's office, where you're not in the office yet, but you're not back out on the street. You're just sort of waiting. It's just this holding space. It can be a physical space like that, or it can be figurative. And we're going through them all the time. And it was like that kind of, I can't think of the name of it, that red car effect. When you think about a red car and all you see is red cars. I started seeing liminality everywhere in my nieces going through adolescence and my siblings going through pregnancies. And yeah, that space between grief and healing and divorces and exams taking place and, you know, menopause, like there's so many of these spaces. And then sort of newer spaces to me with like my transgender friends who are transitioning and like very literally going through a transition, that kind of thing. So I just started seeing it absolutely everywhere. And I started to realize that like when you're in it, things seem to stand still. It's almost like you get frustrated because you're not at the next thing yet.
Hmm.
Or you get frustrated because you can't let go of that last rung yet. You're still sort of holding on. You can't quite reach for that. And you're in this. And you get really annoyed at yourself. And I think I wanted to find maybe the positive in it and kind of celebrate that space and look at it more like a cocoon, like a chrysalis. When a caterpillar goes into that state and there's a little metamorphosis taking place, and actually so much of the change, so much of the growth that we go through happens in those in-between spaces that we don't really give enough credit for. So we've been talking about the book being very, I think it sounds really heavy and it sounds really torturous, but actually there's so much healing that takes place in those spaces. So I sort of wanted to, like really get into the nitty gritty and the dark and the worst, lowest points of that, but then look at how the phoenix sort of rises back out of that again.
The butterfly coming out of the chrysalis. I love that.
Yeah, and until you have that time of deep healing, you can't move on to the next stage, and you want to get there. So,
And sometimes so much that you bypass it.
Yeah.
The only way around is through, and I think so true with grief, and it's something I explored in my first book, Out of Love, as well. I keep coming back to grief because I just find it such an interesting topic, but it really is that idea of like, you gotta go through it. I'm so sorry.
I know it's
awful. It's the worst possible thing, and you feel like you're going to die. And I know that, but you kind of have to just lean in and feel the feels and process it to get through to the inside.
Yes. And I think I've taken in my life, like you just said, you try to bypass it. I've always tried to bypass it. I've held on to the only constant in life is change. And so I keep trying to change, but it's you can't bypass it. You have to just stay there in that moment, in that stage.
Well, and of course we want to. It doesn't feel nice.
Yes, exactly.
I'm watching Netflix till 2 a.m. I'm scrolling, and we're doing it all the time, like just to avoid that negative feeling. And it's such a shame that there's no perfect and there's no pill and there's no way around, and you gotta but I think there's a way of feeling it gently. I think there's a way of holding yourself gently in it, and I wouldn't say that Kate necessarily does this.
It's
all about her learning process. She doesn't know how to. She wasn't held when she was younger. Her father was quite he detached after her mother's death, and aside from an aunt who wasn't always in the picture, she wasn't taught, like so many of us, she didn't see an example of really holding yourself with love and with care and with compassion and taking that time to feel. So she didn't know. So she's figuring it all out at this age, which again, so many of us do. We get to adulthood and then we have a huge heartbreak and we're like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do.
Well, we love that you're exploring that. It is something that's anyone can relate to.
Yeah.
No matter your circumstances. You had mentioned just now Out of Love. In an interview for that novel, you had said, the journey from writing horror to writing love stories was a short one. There's nothing more horrific than love, which I loved that. I am always talking about the thin line between love and hate, which is a little different, but that feeling of falling in love can be so scary. So tell me about what that means for you, that kind of connective tissue between horror and love. And how it made so much sense for you.
You got my mischief laugh there, because I love horror so much. I had kind of cut my teeth on horror. And it's funny, I don't watch an awful lot of horror films. I'm very affected by them. I have PTSD myself, and I've experienced night terrors a lot in my life, and that kind of stuff. Like, I've got enough. I'm all good. So I tend not to consume that much horror, but I grew up like reading Stephen King, and I think it was such an eye-opener. I remember the day my sister handed me It and told me to read it. And I was like, no, you're good. I saw the picture of the scary clown.
Yeah.
Like, thank you. She was like, it's not about horror. It's about friendship. And she insisted, she said, I promise you, this is about friendship. And it was. And it's one of the most crucial sentences I ever heard. And one of the most crucial experiences was reading that book, because it showed me how healing a genre horror can be. And I think you get a lot of sort of trauma porn these days, and I think a lot of horror leans into just being as gratuitous as possible. If that's what you're into, cool, I'm not. But I think what I tend to lean towards is using horror as a vehicle to explore the human condition, and in particular grief and healing. There's some gorgeous examples of anything Jordan Peele has made, for a start. And then I saw a film called The Humans, directed by Stephen Corin. It was based on his stage play and then adapted into a film. And it's ostensibly about a family dinner in New York. Just a family get together to have a dinner. But like from the very opening shot, I was like, oh my God, I think there's horror in this. Mm-hmm. And then as it went through, there were just these tendrils of horror creeping throughout the whole thing. And it sort of bends the genres. And I was so inspired by that.
I love that.
So yeah, I think I had been writing a lot of horror. I'd done some short horror pieces. I got to talk to Guillermo del Toro one time about that because I was like, huge. And I just fangirled it.
That is amazing. Yeah,
like
wow.
Master of horror. He's incredible.
Yes. But that feeling well. Horror, that he does that so well. Yes. And that
like
masked.
Water.
Yeah.
And Pan's Labyrinth. And, you know, there's so, like, he has such good examples of that healing horror. So I think that was what I meant when I said that the journey from love to horror is, it's not long. And people were so shocked when I came out with the book. I think everyone was expecting, well, Hazel's going to do some horror, some sci-fi, like she's going to lean in that direction. And it's very grounded out of love. It's a very, very grounded story about a relationship told in reverse. But then people could see the little moments where sort of horror crept in through her psyche or whatever. And then having said love is the most horrific thing I could think of, I then went and wrote Better by Far. And again, I don't want to spoil anything, but it took me places I wasn't expecting it to go. And then those horror roots sort of started to creep back in parts, and it became integral to Kay's healing journey. Because again, it's that thing of sitting with the monster, of like looking at it, of like that pile of clothes at the end of the bed that looks so scary in the dark. But if you sit with it and you turn the light on and you look at it properly, you realize it's just actually a pile of clothes and you can deal with this. And it's sort of sitting with that monster and going to those darkest places so that you can come back from them.
And being vulnerable. I mean, that's really what's underneath it all.
Underneath it all, and love and in horror, you're right, not so far apart. And your novel does this genre mashup so well. You said you liked hearing your words read to you. Well, I'm going to do it again, because I'm telling you, this is one of those books where I could have read. I mean, there are so many quotable, readable passages. It's just lyrically written. I mean, it's beautiful. And this one really jumped out at me. So I want to read one about love. Kate says, "I don't believe in love at first sight, and I don't believe in soulmates. I believe that with 7 billion people knocking about, there's bound to be at least a couple hundred you could happily spend the rest of your life with, some of whom you'll never meet, some of whom you'll meet at the wrong time, and some of whom you'll meet and never even know you met." So we share the same name, Kate and I, but I'm not sure we share the same point.
But that quote was all Corinne. Yeah.
Yeah. I know. Thank you. So, especially the soulmates part. Okay. Mm-hmm. There's a lot I could get on board with there, but it made me stop. It made me stop and enough to want to ask you about it, because it is something Corinne and I debate. We love to talk about whether there's one true love, like capital T, capital L. We also love to talk about how timing plays into that, how multiverses do, meaning you can love someone in one life and maybe another. Like, we just did Past Lives, that movie. We covered it, but we talk about it all the time. So, this was just something I'm like, I wanted to ask Hazel about this. I would get your thoughts on this.
So that is one of my beliefs I've loaned to Kate. I do sometimes give my characters my own beliefs, and sometimes not. Sometimes they completely, they're at odds with what I believe, but that one's all me. Mm-hmm. And I love that you're like, you know what, I don't believe that. And I think that's the whole thing with having a character. I got accused a lot in Out of Love of writing an unlikable protagonist. And I'm like, that's great. Like, the fact that you feel something about her, like, is great. And I like that you disagree with things that she said. I like that she's opinionated enough and fleshed out enough that you find her unlikable. You know, there's something kind of nice about that, weirdly. And with Kate, I mean, she also says later in the book that, like, she's really struggling with creativity, and she's really struggling with, like, why the hell would I spend all my days sitting indoors writing? Because she's a writer as well. I loaned that to her. Why would I do that when the world is basically ending? You know, when all we're seeing on the news is climate change and just the most horrific things taking place from morning to night every day, and you know, crooked politicians and genocide and these these things that just feel like the world is coming to an end, at least as we know it, or that human kindness maybe is coming to an end. What are we doing? Like, what are we doing getting up every morning and going to work? And she sort of starts to fantasize about like just a nice extinction level event. You know, nothing painful, like maybe an asteroid or something that's just quick and just takes us out and lets the Earth just be the Earth again and rewild without these awful humans on the planet who all they do is cause destruction. Anyway, she's opinionated is what I'm saying. But this one, yeah, I do believe that. I think I have met so many wonderful humans, and I've also in the past year, this book was very strangely synchronized with me. I'm sorry, I'm going so many times.
No, we love that. And yeah, we hear that a lot. We hear that a lot.
Oh, it's crazy. The stuff that manifested and synchronized. And it was, exactly. But I was going through a breakup and trying to write my second novel while Kate was going through a breakup and trying to write her second novel and sharing a house with a person. And I had based that on a previous breakup where that had happened, but now it's happening again. And it was like, there were so many strange things. But as a result of coming out of that relationship in the past sort of year and a half, I've changed so much as a person, and I've being single again and getting to explore my bisexuality in particular has been really exciting and fun, and traveling all around the world and meeting lots of different people. And I was in my first open relationship last year as well. And I think what I'm learning from all those experiences is just how much love there is, especially the women in my life who held, like who really had me through this experience. The new friends I've made and formed, and this sort of blurring of lines for me between friendship and romantic love as well, and how we put all the emphasis on romantic love when actually, God, it's those friends at the end of the day who are the real loves of our life. And I just, I feel like it's almost like there's so many people I couldn't choose, and there's so many wonderful people who day to day make me laugh and smile and support me and share life with me in such a beautiful way that actually I think there's probably loads of them out there that I quite happily settle down with and spend a really beautiful life with. And they'd all be different. They're sort of multiverses of their own.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I think it's, you know, it puts so much pressure on it, this idea of this one person that you have to find, or you've done it wrong somehow. And, you know, I also think people have multiple loves. They spend decades with a partner who maybe, you know, passes away, and then they meet another love later on in life. Mm-hmm. And I just think there's so much to go around.
Yeah.
No, it, I love it, that.
It puts pressure on it in one way or another way. For me, it just seems so scarcity mindset. Like,
yeah, I was just going to say that.
There's, how about abundance of love? Isn't that a better way to see things? And how limited I would be and feel if there was just one.
I also love the expansion to friendship and of female friends of mine. I absolutely agree with that. But I was sitting here thinking, as you guys were talking, I'm like, it's a scarcity mindset. And you said it. Yeah.
Like there's not enough. Yeah. It's also the thing, it's that societal thing of like constantly telling us you can get it wrong.
Yeah.
You know, like be sure and choose the right career because you could get it wrong. And be sure and choose the right person because you could. And like as if you can't change your career at 40.
Right.
As if you can't change your relationship. Sure. Any,
yeah.
Right? Any day. No. Like it's kind of scarcity.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I love that. See, guys? Look at this. This is why we're talking about it. We're evolving right here on the episode.
Yes.
So we've talked a lot about Kate. I do want to just also talk about some of the subplots where you get into more themes of grief and love and loss. Kate's helping her best friend, Jenna, who's going through IVF. Her other friend, Fran, who's facing struggles, you know, coming out as trans. So talk to us about why you wanted to include those and how, again, you sort of just broadened this theme of love and loss, because that's what those two are dealing with, too, in very different ways. But
yeah, I was talking about this. I run a writing retreat now called Write to Yourself. And on the last session of the last retreat, someone actually asked about how do you write characters? Like, what a broad question. Sometimes I get asked someone, I'm like, I'm not qualified. I'm just a girl writing books in a room on my shoulder. But yeah, she was like, how do you know? Like, what characters need to be in it? How do you know who they are? Where do you begin? And it really got me thinking about, like, oh, why do I write the characters I write? And why did Fran and Janet and whoever make it into the book and the other ones didn't, you know?
Right.
And I think for me, with everything in the book, with everything, it's always in service of the story. So every plot point, every little detail, every character, every line of dialogue should, in theory, be in service of the story. So the scene, you know, and I came from screenwriting, so there's also that thing of, like, can you break down, can, like, every little scene, every scene should be a story in itself. You know, every block, every act should kind of serve its own story, and then you get bigger and bigger to one big story. But if you break them down, which is why I tend to write, I think, in chapters that are almost short stories in themselves, because I started writing short stories years and years ago. But yeah, those characters, for me, they're all serving a story, which for me was exploring what we talked about, the liminality, especially of grief, but liminality in different forms. And so for me, every character should be in that state of liminality in some form, because ultimately I get to explore it that way. And the process is not about coming out with a book at the end. That's great. But it's also about me going on a journey and a process as an author, and you going on a journey and a process as a reader of exploring a topic and a story with me. So yeah. You get to explore it from all these different vantage points with these different characters. It's basically the thinking behind.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about this before. Grief has a specific place with loss, yeah. With death. And maybe I'll give that the capital G because it's not the same, but there is a little bit of grief in everything we do.
Everything. I
mean, there's a process of evolution, of being immersed in something and then letting it go. And there are feelings involved with that. And with that is grief. And it doesn't have to be this, like, oh, I don't have a right to feel grief because something huge hasn't happened. But
grief is when something great happens. And I think that's the thing. I can't remember if it was Brené Brown.
It is.
About being there for someone when a huge change happens, even if it's positive. Someone wanted a baby and got pregnant, or someone wanted that promotion and they got it, or they wanted to get married and it's happening, or they wanted to publish a book and the book has just been published. Mm-hmm. That's terrifying. But sometimes...
I love you, Hazel. Thank you.
This is going nicely into your next question.
Great. Loss of, you're losing something. Yeah. Like, even if you're moving, like when I moved from Ireland to London, it was this huge opportunity. I was working for Google. It was a great opportunity. My boyfriend at the time was living there. It was a whole new life, a whole new adventure. So exciting. But Jesus Christ, I saw the plane because I was leaving home behind. Like, there's always, in every new step, good or bad, there's always... It's the Joni Mitchell line, something's lost but something's gained, which is in the book at one point. Like, there's always the give and take. And I think we need to allow, again, it's just the allowing. It's just the sitting with feelings and saying, that's okay that I'm feeling that, rather than punishing ourselves. But a great thing happened. Why am I feeling grief around that? I should be happy. Should. Like, no. You get to feel the spectrum all the time.
Yeah.
For every eventuality.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, and right sizing that is a challenge because it's not in the, I guess, the collective dialogue, right? When people say, you know, oh, your debut's coming out in 3 months, how do you feel? All they want to hear is excited, wonderful, amazing, yes. And it is those things. It's also more layered, more complicated. Yes, as you said, terrifying. I want to touch really quickly on something that you gave to Kate about writing and maybe your creative process. You wrote, writing for me isn't about putting words on a page. It's about putting yourself on the page, leaving so much of myself there that I go to bed wondering if perhaps this time I gave too much away, whether I've kept enough to get by on. And that just, I mean, I am in the throes of trying to write another book and I am putting lots of words on the page, and you really might have just unlocked something for me, because what I haven't put yet on the page is myself. And I haven't found myself in this story. And like you, I also give my care, and I've given them some of my DNA, right? I've made a lawyer, I've made a writer, I've given themselves little seeds of me, but that essence, that struggle, there's something deeper of myself that I haven't quite given them. So it's, right now it's just words on a page. So I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about that. Yeah.
That's gorgeous. Thanks. Again, you know, it's another one of the ways that this book took me in directions I didn't expect and plan. And one of them was her writing process and trying to write the book. I didn't really know what it was until I wrote that first line. I was in a really bad headspace myself. In a very long-term relationship that was very on and off, that really should have been off far sooner. We kept breaking up, but couldn't commit to being breaking up and broken up and kept getting back together. One of those bloody things. But I was in a bad way and took myself off to this yoga retreat in the middle of nowhere in Spain. It was just post COVID, so they'd like slashed their prices and no one was really traveling yet, and I got to be there for a whole month, which is huge.
Ah,
that's wow. I know I'm so lucky. This is not standard.
Amazing.
But I wrote that first line there. I was just banging my head against a wall, and then one day I was sitting there and it was like out of nowhere, that full eureka moment. It was like, I'm supposed to be writing a book, but instead I find myself writing to you. And within that sentence was kind of the blueprint for the whole book. I knew now it was in the second person. She was addressing everything to Finn, her ex, so she's going to be talking to him even though he's not there. She's going to be trying to write a book at the same time, and also it was all going to be from her perspective. Initially it was supposed to be chapter by chapter, back and forth, her week, his week, her week, his week. And as I made notes and notes and notes, reams of notes, thousands of words of notes, I realized they were all Kate's. I didn't really have much to say.
Okay.
And then I realized that the absence of his voice was then going to act as this sort of ghostly presence, and would say the silence would say so much more than anything he could say, because we've all been there where you've gone no contact and you can't reach somebody. So when it became about her writing process and her writing this book, it got me thinking so much about art and what it means to be an artist and what it means to give yourself to that art. I think we talk a lot about, you know, the long-suffering artist, suffering for your art, sacrificing. But what is that sacrifice? I think we always think of it in terms of time, maybe. Oh, I didn't go to that party because I sacrificed to be at home. But it's kind of sacrificing little pieces of yourself. It's those tiny million paper cuts that you make in order to get those little droplets onto the page. And it's when you give your characters all your flaws and your fears and those deep-seated shit that you're afraid to really look at, and you kind of allow them to look at it for you or with you. So that quote, the idea of leaving so much of yourself on the page, was inspired by Annie Dillard, who's mentioned in the book. Her book, The Writing Life, is just, anyone who reads or writes or creates anything or is in, anyone who is in human should read the book, The Writing Life. Such a beautiful book. And she talks about the creative process in such a unique way. And there is this piece, which I'm going to not quote correctly, but it's like, spend it, shoot it, you know, leave it all on the field. And it's the, you know, an athlete does it and an engineer does it. Everyone does it when they really love what they do and they go in for the day. And, you know, a mother does it, a caretaker does it. You give your all, you give pieces of yourself, and you walk away with a little less, but also a little more for having given and having had the experience.
Yes.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. And I did it on book one, but it's a whole new process all over again.
Talks about, she has this moment of like, she's on the phone to her agent and who is my agent, and she's like, I don't know, I gave it all, I don't know how to write book two because all of me is in book one, it's there, it's on the shelf, I don't have any more. And the agent's like, no, I'm not worried, like, you'll find more. And she says, how? And the agent says, magic. And she goes, there's a magic to it. It fills from the bottom up.
Yeah,
you know, it's and when you go back in, there's always more. There's always more.
And to add to that, I am also in the, and to bring back our earlier discussion, I'm also in the liminal phase. My book has had a wonderful reception in the publishing industry, but when it's out there to readers, will I need to protect myself? Will I need to change who I am and what I put out there? And writing in that liminal space is hard because I do have more to give, but I'm scared to give it, and because I don't know yet how it will be received.
Sculpt it, you know, like give it all in the first instance, put it all down. There's stuff that didn't make it. There's things I absolutely had to change for, you know, legal reasons and other reasons, but...
That's
right. More fiction. Without a blog, that was way more the case. But I think it's just about, in that first instance of, you know, bleeding on the page, as Hemingway says. You just bleed, and you can edit later. All that stuff happens later. Yeah,
you're right.
You get it out in the first, but it's hard. It's, cracking yourself open day after day, and it's hard. And it took me months and months and months. I had this idea in my head for so long before I even had one sentence to begin with. Mm-hmm.
Well, Hazel, thank you. Really helped unlock something for me.
I love that. I thought of that scene of, I thought of you, Corinne, with that, with her, you know, but I like the bleeding. Let it bleed. I know. Like, it's so easy. Just bleed. Yes. Come on.
Just bleed. Just bleed. Just sit down on the page. To the typewriter and bleed. There's nothing.
And then do it. And then do it again. And do it again. And do it again. And do it again.
The second that book comes out, like, literally, they're on the phone. What's the next one? And I'm starting to write book three while I'm still here talking to you about book two. It's not even out.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm planning the launch in New York and I'm planning all these things, but I'm all, my head's already with the next set of characters.
Yeah.
What the character is. It's
awesome. Talk about a liminal space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Yes. God, yes.
It wouldn't change it for the world though.
No, that's right. No.
Well, we have come to the topic that I mentioned earlier, which is astrology. And I said to you before we started taping that from your Instagram, I mean, I figure we are somewhat kindred spirits. You post about eclipses and Mercury retrograde and the planets being stationed direct and all sorts of things that we get into. There's even a bit in the book where Jenna's dragging Kate to a full moon ritual. So I'm like, absolutely, she's our people. So I do know from your posts as well, we usually ask their authors, what's their sign and do you relate? But you are a triple Aquarius, which I don't know that we've had a triple, someone that has the same sun, moon, and rising.
I don't
think. To the extent people actually know theirs. Again,
that's
not
right.
Everyone
Good point.
Knows
Good point.
All of that.
Right.
But anyway, your birthday post pics are also amazing. I don't know who's styling you for those, but I just love it. But what is your relationship to astrology? We would love to hear.
Oh, such a question. Well, firstly, my Instagram is a hot mess of books, memes, and
I love it.
I don't
love
know what's happening on
love
Instagram
it.
Right now.
Yeah.
We've gone in a direction and we're staying the course. I have really leaned into the whole sort of astrology thing as well, but in a tongue-in-cheek kind of way. I think, and I said this to someone the other day, they were like, you're posting a lot of astrology memes. And I'm like, yeah, because the people who really believe in it are all bought in. And the people who think it's hilarious and silly and ironic find them funny. So, like, the audience is everyone.
Yes.
It's just funny, whoever you are. Yeah. But I think... So, I this is a longer story. I'll try to keep it short. I was raised Catholic. Massively went the other way around age 12. Was like, this doesn't make any sense to me and I don't agree. So completely went the other way of full atheism. There's nothing more. It's just us. Blackness after death and so on. And I think I was kind of a bitch about it. I think, you know, in my 20s, I had pushed, and I understand why, but I pushed so far the other direction that I had a real disdain for anyone who was not only religious but spiritual. Like, I thought they were kind of idiots for thinking. And then in my 30s, going through an awful lot of therapy and just experiences in life where I met other people and that broadened my horizon of you know, what people believe in, and having my own experiences, I realized that I there was sort of another shift happening in me, and I had gone too far in the other direction. I'd overcompensated and I was wrong, and you know, it was unfair to feel that way about people. And I'd say in the last sort of 10 years, I've really discovered spirituality. Like, it was there the whole time, but again, it's that thing of finding words for something or finding a way to experience it. And so now it's so much more to me, and astrology is the same about, as a writer, everything for me is telling stories. So in therapy, I talked an awful lot about the stories we tell ourselves, and I learned new language for, you know, when you approach a friend, instead of saying, you haven't texted me back in a week, you say, the story I'm telling myself is that you don't want to talk to me, or I've done something wrong because I haven't heard from you. Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk about that story with you, you know, and it's identifying this, separating from the story and the fact.
Yes.
And find the diagram, because usually it's a Venn diagram.
Yes.
So yeah, with astrology, with tarot, with moon rituals, any of that kind of stuff, I think, especially now writing this book, I've become so much more connected to sort of ancient druidic Irish practices, the ancient Celts, and the Wheel of the Year, and the festival. So this story begins at Halloween. They break up on Halloween, which is our most liminal day. It's when the threshold, we thought, it actually came from the Irish Samhain festival, or Iha Hauna is the night before Halloween. So it's when the threshold between worlds is thinnest, and the spirits can sort of pass through this threshold. And it's also the sort of the beginning of something new and the birth of something new going into winter. And there's so many, also very strange thing happened. I actually went through a breakup on Halloween, having written about her going through a breakup on Halloween. It was very, very strange things happened.
Trust me. Yeah, I get it.
So,
I get it.
It's happened to me too. About how I kind of, did I manifest my breakup or what the hell happened?
Yes.
But I think, you know, that like the Wheel of the Year, those festivals, the moon, those cycles, our seasons, our days, the fact that our menstrual cycle happens to match the moon, which is just a rock that goes around the earth. Why?
Yes.
You know, I don't know, and it's weird. There's all these sort of strange synchronicities that I think help us. So when I'm, say, reading about this month, the moon is in, there's a full moon in Pisces, for example.
Yeah.
And there's a real fluidity and a softness and a sort of leaning into our emotions and that kind of thing. And then there's a new moon in Aries, which is more about moving forward and forging a path. And it's more yin than yang. This may or may not be true, but it's a beautiful reflection time. The same way that the spread of tarot cards can be, the same way that the Wheel of the Year or the seasons can be, you know, that winter is bedding down and getting cozy, and it's not a time for doing, making, happening. It's a time for reflecting and cocooning. And then we come out of that, and there's the spring and the new birth and the moving forward. Mm-hmm. Like, I just feel that as humans, we are programmed with all these cycles, and to benefit from, I think we really benefit emotionally and physically from cycles. So I've come to a place where I'm like, I don't know what it all means, but I find it helpful in my day to day. So
correct.
Cool.
Yes.
Say Mercury. That's my favorite one. You know, when everything goes to shit and you're just like, well, Mercury's a retrograde.
Yes.
Not me. I didn't make that choice.
Yes.
Yeah. And this year it's mixed in between eclipse season. I mean, it's chaos. It's really chaos
full moon. It was with Aries, I think.
Aries.
Aries, and it was retrograde, and there was eclipses happening. And there
was
just a lot going on.
Yes.
It's falling apart.
But Hazel, I love what you said, that it provides us a story. And if that story works for you and it's something that could help you move forward or see something about yourself, jump on it. And if it doesn't, then keep moving.
Fine.
Same thing with meditation, I think, often. I'll look at like full moon journal prompts, for example.
Yes.
And it'll just be things that probably wouldn't have occurred to me otherwise.
To think about.
Exactly right.
Yeah, just a word or a thought or a theme to meditate on can be so helpful when everything's so scattered and so much and so big all of the time, to just have these focal points,
like
seasons or cycles or astrology or whatever you want it to be, I think can be really helpful for us.
Yes. Yeah. And that's how we use it. I mean, exactly like you're saying, I have this tarot book here. She knows I love tarot, but it does have the moon cycles and these prompts, like you're saying. And and I just also, for someone like me, it will get me to sit and do that reflection that I probably wouldn't otherwise do. So it's already a benefit.
The community, the fact that we're even talking about it, the fact that you'll probably do readings. I love when friends get together and we do tarot readings, because what it does is it throws up questions about our lives that we end up having conversations about, where we are in our career or our romantic life or our family or our past or where our hopes, our dreams, like we end up having it's prompts for these conversations. Mm-hmm. And the community, and what happens in the book with Kate going to the moon ritual, even though she's this is
exactly
whatsoever, she ends up going and realizing there's a community to be found. And it's not that the moon is in itself magic, but there's magic to be found in women gathering in a circle to share and to grieve and to heal and to speak their stories and have their voices heard and to sing and dance and celebrate. Like, that's magic. And if we do that around a fire or a moon, who cares? It doesn't it doesn't matter what the centerpiece is at all.
Hazel, love that. Well, we could talk to you all day.
Literally. And then some.
Yes.
We're just scratching the surface here. But
yeah, exactly. But thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Genuinely, thank you. This has been such a lovely chat. And as I said, I'm only starting to really talk to people about the book now. So it's really been so lovely to hear two people who've connected with it. And I really appreciate the questions are so interesting as well.
It's gorgeous. Good. Well, thank you.
Yeah, and Better by Far is out now.